I think all parents at some level are focused on how do you relate your worldview and your sense of value, what matters in the world to your kids. And we tell our kids all the time, they're really lucky because both of their parents are writers. And at any point, they can turn to things, TV shows, and now this book I wrote, they can turn to those things and get a sense of who their parents were and what their parents cared about and valued and thought about the world.
Welcome to The Art of Fatherhood, a podcast that takes you on the journey of fatherhood. Now here's your host, Art Eddy.
This week's The Art of Fatherhood podcast is being brought to you by RPACT. RPACT is the one app every parent needs to keep their children safe when surfing the internet, playing online games, or engaging with social media. RPACT's goal is to assist parents in teaching children healthy digital habits and responsible proper use of their device. RPACT is easy to use, easy to set up, and great for parents and families who are concerned with their child's use of technology. Whether you're introducing a device to your child for the very first time or simply have a teenager that spends way too much time on social media and other device apps, RPACT is the perfect parental control app solution for your family to encourage a healthy balance between technology and face-to-face social interaction. From scheduling device-free time for the family, schoolwork, or disconnecting, to screen time allowance, specific app blocking, website filtering, family location, screenshots of your child's device, RPACT is the most comprehensive parental control app and family locator tool that is perfect for families of any size. For more information and to download the RPACT app, go to their website at rpact.com or find RPACT in your mobile device app store. What's going on, everybody? Art Eddy here for another edition of the Art of Fatherhood podcast. And I'm very excited to have this guy. He's a great guy. Can't wait to talk about fatherhood. Michael Schurer, thanks for taking the time to chat with me, sir. How you doing?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Doing well, man. Two Boston Red Sox fans are going to be talking about a lot of different things, maybe some baseball here and there. I don't know. But first, I like to bring good guys like yourself to talk about their fatherhood journey. When you found out you were going to be a dad, sir, what was going through your mind?
Pure excitement and happiness. Always wanted to be a dad. My wife always wanted to be a mom. It was like, let's try to have kids. Got pregnant. Nothing but happiness. It wasn't like a purely easy journey for us. Like, it wasn't like the, you know, you hear stories sometimes about like, we decided to have a kid, we had sex, we got pregnant, we had a kid. Like, it wasn't quite that straightforward, but all things being equal, we were pretty lucky. And it was nothing but happiness. I was fairly young for my friend group. I would say I got married when I was 29. And I think my wife got pregnant, I think like 3 years later or something like that. So we were young enough that we were, when I did the math, I was like, this is good. Like, my kids will be like in college when I'm young enough to be able to like still live a life, but also old enough where I wasn't a complete moron. So I think we did it pretty well. Like, we planned it out pretty well and the timing worked out.
Love it. Yeah. There is that math. You're like, all right, when are they finally out of the house? Right. Where am I going to be in this scheme of things?
You start and the math starts before they're born. You're like, okay, wait, what? It's 19 years from now.
I love it. Especially with shows like The Good Place. And of course your book, you try and throw positivity out there. And I think you and your wife are going to probably use what you write about, especially with your career, into some of the values that you talk about that people should be striving for, right? So this might be like low-hanging fruit, but what is, you know, let's talk about some of the values you're looking to instill into them.
Yeah, it's a great point because I think all parents at some level are focused on how do you relate your worldview and your sense of value, what matters in the world to your kids. And we tell our kids all the time, they're really lucky because both of their parents are writers. And at any point, they can turn to things, TV shows, and now this book I wrote, they can turn to those things and get a sense of who their parents were and what their parents cared about and valued and thought about the world, which is a really rare and kind of wonderful thing. Like, if my kids wonder how I feel about the government, well, I wrote a TV show about that. And if they care about what I think about, you know, moral values and philosophies, like, I wrote a TV show about that. It gives me a sense of calm because I feel like, that sense that you have of like, I'm just desperation to instill in your children the things that you care about or think are important. They have documents from both of their parents that they can look at and kind of mull over long after we're gone. So there are things that I now consciously, I think, write about in an attempt to kind of communicate to them. Like I actively now think in a way I, of course, never used to, like, how does this, is this a good thing for my kids to learn about? You know, I remember early on in the show Parks and Recreation, which was the first show I ever ran, there was a moment where we heard through the grapevine that Sasha and Malia Obama had been watching the show and liked it. I think they were Amy Poehler fans. And I had this, like, you know, my kids were very young at that time. And I suddenly had this sense of like a renewed sense of responsibility of like, we would write some really like dirty joke. And I'd be like, I think President Obama might be watching this show with his daughter. Like, do I want him and his daughter to see this joke? And, you know, ultimately, like, you can't write for any audience of one anywhere. And it didn't stop us necessarily from doing anything we didn't want, we were going to do or whatever. But when it's your own kids, you have that times 1,000 because you think like, well, my kids are going to watch this someday. And over the pandemic, my kids watched a bunch of shows that my wife and I have worked on. And I did occasionally have the thought of like, I wish I could go back in time and take that joke out. It's a little dirty. Now I do it very consciously. Now I think I'm thinking about my kids and I'm thinking about their friends and the fact that they're now old enough to watch these shows. And it does, I don't think it necessarily changes what I write, but it does make me think twice about certain things or wonder whether it's a good idea to put in a certain joke or a storyline or something.
Mike, the idea of thinking before, like thinking twice before you do an action, if only people did that, right?
Yeah, what a novel concept.
But this, so your answer actually kind of bleeds into my next question, where I think, you know, especially you and your wife are writers and you guys take a look at not just things or characters or stories from one point of view, but from many points of view and how people would take that in. So maybe you and your wife have talked about this, but what is something that your kids have taught you about life or just about yourself in general that maybe, you know, you knew was kind of there, but then your kids definitely accented so much, you're like, oh my God, yeah, like they taught me this. I'm guessing you have a bunch of those things, right?
Yeah, there's a million of them. I mean, you know, the one of the great and also frustrating things about parenthood to me is that you can, it has almost nothing to do with whatever your abilities are in other arenas. So you think to yourself, I'm gonna be good at this because I was good at, I was like a good student in college, or like I'm a good manager of people in the workplace or whatever. That has nothing to do with parenthood, like zero. And my wife created a show called Single Parents that ran on ABC for a few years. And that was explicitly, obviously, about parenthood, as the name suggests. And I think a thing that show got really, did really well was it articulated like there is an emotional intelligence that is specific to the concept of parenthood that has very little to do with any other kind of emotional intelligence and almost nothing to do with actual, like, you know, academic intelligence. And it is a thing that it's a discipline that you just need to learn anew. Like, it's a new thing. It's a new skill that no one can teach you, that you have no experience with, and that takes like incredible amounts of effort and attention to your job. And, you know, there are children who require, you know, a really strong, firm sense of like rule setting and boundary setting. There are children who flourish much better in a much more free flowing environment. You don't know which of those kinds of creatures your child is until your child teaches you what kind of creature they are. And then you have to adapt to them. Like if you take a square peg and a round hole approach to it, all you're doing is setting up a lifetime of conflict and misery. And it's not that you have to bend to your child's will at all, because I think that's also bad. If you let your child dictate the way that they're raised, that's not good. But you do have to learn how they flourish and how they function, and then adapt whatever you thought of as your parenting style to them and make it so that you're taking the right approach with them in anything, in the way that you that you talk to them, discipline them, reward them, anything that you're doing, like it, you have to take your cues from them at some level in order to get the most out of them and make them as happy and safe as they can be. So yeah, I think the learning is much more directional from the kid to the parent than it is from the parent to the kid. Like I have a 14-year-old son and an 11-year-old daughter. They're completely different people. What works for one does not work for the other. Like all of the things that you think you learn with the oldest one, you then apply to the younger one, and it's complete failure, just endless failure and shame and regret. And so yeah, it's a never ending process. I'm hardly the first person to point this out, but it's a never ending process of like gathering information, emotional information, adapting, changing, and reorganizing the way that you go about it.
Well said. Yeah. And I like the fact that, you know, you're talking about just kids in general, like they will show you the cues, right? And you got to pick up on that. Like, mm-hmm. like, cause we're always like, it doesn't come with a handbook. Well, it kind of does, because their actions will kind of give you cues on where to go. And the funniest thing is, like you said, I have two daughters, 14 and 11. So I'm in the same boat as you,
right,
age-wise. And I don't get it, because I had two older sisters growing up. So like we all had different personalities. So I don't know why I thought like they gotta be the same people, yeah, the same personality. So it's just like, I should have known better, you know?
Yes. I'm so with you. Like I have an older sister and a younger sister, and the three of us are very, very different. All of us very different. And yet it did not occur to me really until, you know, years into having kids of my own, like, oh, right. Like if my parents had tried to parent me and my sisters the same, it would have been a massive failure, because we're not the same people. And it's just a wild thing. You know, every parent at some point says to their kid, I can't wait till you have kids of your own. Every single one ever in history has said that. And it doesn't mean anything until you actually have kids of your own. And you're like, oh, that's what they meant. They mm-hmm. meant, because it's funny that you're going to fail so badly at trying to do this stuff, you know?
No doubt, man. One more question before we kind of get into some other things. Can be a dad hack or a piece of advice, and things you already said, especially kind of like looking at your own, the different kids, your different children's views and cues, and seeing like how you should parent them. But is there another dad hack or a piece of advice you'd offer to new parents listening to this?
I mean, to me, the number one mistake that I was going to say my wife and I make, but I would say I make it more than she does, is you have to huddle up before you talk to your kid about anything, big or small. You have to just quick check in, or a serious conversation of like, here's how we're going to approach this. Here's the tack we're taking. Because on a number of occasions, I wouldn't say I've gone rogue, but I've been like, you know what I'm going to say in this situation? I'm going to say this, and I'll bet this will work. And then it does not work. And then my wife will be like, what did you say to her? And I'll be like, I thought it was a good idea. And she's like, no, you don't. Like, and look, if you're going to still fail as parents, you're going to fail all the time. But at least if you have decided on the approach vector, yeah, to whatever the problem is, you fail together and then you can regroup together. If you fail individually, I mean, I'm also saying, obviously, this is a situation in which there's two parents in the house, which is often not the situation. There are other situations that are much trickier and much more difficult if it's not a two-parent home. But if it's a two-parent home, just be on the same page about whatever it is, because you don't want to send mixed messages, and you really don't want to be the one who like freelanced and then blew it. Like that's a lonely island to live on. And I have lived on that island on multiple occasions.
I think we all have. Yeah. And that's no matter if it's the whole thing, it's like a kid comes up to you like, hey, can I play video games? Yeah, go ahead. Sure. And then, you know, your wife comes in and be like, why'd you say yes? Because I told them they're just fighting with each other. I said, no video games. So I'm like, oh, so they, yeah, like the kids got me. They wrote me in.
Yeah. Well, that's the other thing you have to know, is the kids are basically the velociraptors from Jurassic Park. Like they will learn and adapt and like find your weakness. And like, you think they're like sweet and innocent, and then you realize like, oh, they've learned how to open door handles with their little velociraptor arms, and they're coming for us, and they're going to eat us. Like they will go to one parent and say one thing, and then come to you and say something else. Like they are constantly probing and searching for your weaknesses and your soft underbelly, and they will gut you in a second. So that's the other reason why it's important to be on the same page with your other parent, if you have one.
You just made my day with probably not even knowing that, because my first article on parenting was called Kids Are Like Velociraptors.
Whoa. I love it.
So thank you very much for sharing that. We're going to finish off with the Fatherhood Quick Five, but I want to ask you some other questions. Like I said, I'm a big fan of your work, and you know, Saturday Night Live, The Office, Good Place, you know, Parks and Rec, all that, all those, man, like these shows are great because it's like you can relate to certain characters or just relate to certain situations. So I know everyone praises you, so it's not really that, but like, is there like a moment in your career because of where it was when you were writing the project or how much that project meant to you that you were just like, yes, like even though you might have, people have said you've made it, Mike, and all that other good stuff, but is there a project that you worked on that maybe was your, like that was a project you wanted to work out, but first you had to get like maybe the pop song out there first to get on the charts, and then you could kind of explore your stuff. Like my friends and I joke about John Mayer, right? Your body's a wonderland, great. And then all of a sudden he's like, okay, everyone likes me, now I'm gonna do what I really wanted to do, right?
Sure.
I'm not saying that's the same situation for you, but like, is there like a project or a show or just something that you've worked on that was like, yes, this finally got there and people enjoyed it?
Well, yeah, there's a couple moments like that in my career. And there's no career more humbling, I would say, than being a writer, because even in success, you live, you know, scene to scene, joke to joke, moment to moment, episode to episode, like it's a bumpy ride, even in the best of circumstances. So I'm far from believing even now that I've figured anything out or that I know the solution. Like I've worked on plenty of shows that haven't worked for one reason or another, and will continue to, I'm sure. There are a couple moments where I felt like something had clicked. One of them was early on in the run of Parks and Rec. We did our second season, and then Amy Poehler got pregnant, and it meant that she was going to give birth to her second kid right around the time we would have started shooting season 3. And so what we did is essentially we finished season 2 and then we kept going, and we banked a bunch of episodes for season 3. And then the idea was she would go off and have her second kid, and then we would have enough episodes to start the season on time. And then by the time she had recovered, we would be able to shoot again. And then they moved, NBC moved season 3 to mid-season, which was bad for two reasons. Number one, we didn't have to kill ourselves to keep going after 24 episodes of season 3 to make more of them for season or to see, make more of them for season 3. And also getting moved to mid-season at the time was like a death sentence. It basically means, at the time, it meant like we don't really have a lot of faith in the show. And so I was like, well, this might be it. This might be the last season. So what ended up happening is we made all of season 3 in the dark, which now is more commonplace with, you know, shows like places like Netflix where you make an entire season and then it airs. At the time, it was very odd. We made 16 episodes of season 3 without airing any of them. And I remember watching them and editing them and working on them and stuff and thinking like, man, I don't know how much I trust myself, but I think this is really good. Like, I just think this is really good. I think these episodes are funny. I think they work really well. And I don't know if they're even going to see the light of day, but I just believe in them. I believe that this is a good season of TV. And eventually it started airing in January, and it was by far the most well-received season that we had had to that point, and maybe the whole run of the show. And we got nominated for an Emmy that year. And I remember thinking like, this was a really good litmus test for me in my job. Was I did this in the dark. No one else saw what we were doing except me and the editors and the actors and the writers. And I had a gut feeling, and my gut feeling was that we had done a good job. And then when they aired and people liked them, I felt like, okay, I think I understand a little more about what something is when it's good, you know, like that. That was a really big deal for me personally, just to feel like my instinct about it was right. And then, so that's certainly one of them. And then the other thing I think is The Good Place, because The Good Place was a crazy show that was set in the afterlife and had moral philosophy at the center of it. We were talking about really weird, thorny stuff that was hard to, explain to people. And when that show worked and survived and was well received, that felt like an accomplishment, just to have done a taken a big swing and connected. And again, I've taken plenty of swings that have not connected, but that one, like having that idea and believing that there was a way to take those issues and relate them through a half hour TV comedy, and then getting to do that for 4 years, that felt like something.
Yeah. Thank you very much for sharing that. And again, like, I feel like you're knowing my answers, like you're Yoda, like you already know what's coming up next, because Good Place, we started watching that just like, kind of like you said, like during the pandemic, we're looking for shows, and my wife and I, we want to like, just talk about like, if it's a good show, like The Good Place, kind of talk about certain things at dinner table, like, you know, the dinner table, like, hey, we watched, you know, episode 4 of season 2, whatever the case, maybe we start talking about it. Right. And I love the fact that you also kind of give my kids a little leeway to say, like, instead of the F word, it's like fork and all these other things, right? And it's like, all right, I'll let you test your, you know, your vocabulary here and there. And I think it's kind of cute, them saying that instead of the actual words. But
right.
How much did, like, fatherhood or just the idea of that show trying to put – and it was one of the – I just love it just for – just talking about morality and what to do. And like, even when you think things are like, it takes you 3 hours to see if you want this blueberry muffin or this other muffin, right? And you're like, well, that shouldn't be bad, but no, you're wasting other people's time, you're wasting other things. And like, we talk about all of these things where something that might not seem so bad that one person's doing, but could have a ripple effect, right? And you guys do that brilliantly in the show. How much did like kind of fatherhood influence your writing on that show?
It was enormous. It was sort of the genesis of the show was this burgeoning feeling I had that the most important thing that you can do in your life is to work really hard at figuring out what makes a good person, what kinds of things a good person does, what kinds of things a good person doesn't do, why those things are good or bad, gather all that information and then pass it on to someone. In my case, it's my kids. And anyone who else who cares to listen to me yammer at cocktail parties, but really my kids. And so that feeling of like, I think this is really all people look for a meaning, you know, they look for meaning in life. The question of like, what does this all mean has plagued humanity since humanity was a thing. And I think the closest I can come to an answer is like, that is the meaning of life. The meaning of life is to figure out what you think is good or bad, collect it all into like a big juicy pile of information, and then pass it on to the next round of people so that they can try to understand it better than you did. And I don't think I would have necessarily written The Good Place if I didn't have kids. I think that it was the feeling of, In Jewish culture, which I'm not Jewish, but in Jewish culture, it's called the moral will, right? It's not just like, here's who gets my stuff. It's here's who gets what I've learned about the world. And I was obsessed with, or interested in at least, the concept of morality before I had kids, but I don't think I would have written a whole show about it if I didn't have kids, because at some level, the entire show and the book I wrote afterwards are simply me trying to collect in one place the sum total of what I think is true about morality and the decisions we make and the kind of people we should be, and to create a document for my kids to watch and for their kids to watch and for their kids to watch. And by the way, I'm under no illusion that my great grandkids will ever see The Good Place. Like, other things will come along, the world will be different, they'll all be wearing VR goggles and floating in outer space with Jeff Bezos's brain in a jar or whatever. And so like that, I believe that this is going to stand the test of time, but in the moment it was this sense of like, I have this opportunity for this thing I'm interested in to try to put it down as a document, to try to make something that is tangible that they could look at and understand as they grow up.
And it, not only a gift to your kids, but just gift to like a great way for parents to talk to their kids. And we can say something and they're not going to listen to it. Like, I'm a basketball coach for my oldest daughter and I'll say something, she won't do it. The other coach will say it and she'll do it. And I'm like,
of course.
Huh. Okay. Cool. I'm like, hey, Frank, do you mind just calling up and being like, and my daughters are great, but I'm just like, I'd always be like, hey, can you mind like just telling her to be nicer to her sister on like on a Tuesday at 8 o'clock? Is that cool? Because she listens to you.
Oh, I mean, that's the, you know, we hear from when our son, who's 14, comes home from being at a friend's house, their parents will usually say, like, he's such a sweet kid. He's so polite. He's so nice. He's really like chatty, really like is a like a just a really great kid. And we're always like, huh, really? That is not our experience. Like, he is sullen and annoyed at us at all times. And there is something like there does need to be a buffer between you and your kids sometimes in terms of how they receive information. Like, if you tell them something or instruct them in a certain way, whether it's how to set a pick on a pick and roll or how to be nice to their siblings or whatever, you say to them, forget it. Someone else says it to them, it sinks in. It's just a natural aspect of like growing up, is that they are skeptical of their parents and everything their parents say to them. And that's why I thought, like, well, if I say this stuff, they will roll their eyes and ignore me. But if Kristen Bell and Will Harper and Manny Jacinto say it, then maybe they'll listen. And that really is, that was a calculation I was making without question.
Love it, man. Two more questions before I finish off with the Fatherhood Quick Five. Plain and simple, with everything that you've done and like the writing and all that, is it hard to cut off your creative brain? Like, are you just kind of like thinking about something pops up, you just like on a normal Sunday where you're supposed to be relaxing and all of a sudden, oh man, then like you just like, maybe I could write a show about this or this could be like, is it hard to shut off your creative brain?
Yes and no. I mean, the no part is like, I love, like, I'm going to watch the game 4 of the NBA Eastern Conference Finals tonight because I'm a Celtics fan. And I will not think about writing while I'm watching that game. Like, if there are other things I'm interested in, I like reading books. I like watching sports on TV. I like playing catch with my son. I like doing a lot of other things. And when I'm doing those things, my mind isn't like, how can I create a TV show or something? Like, I can compartmentalize fairly effectively, I would say. But the yes part of it, the part that where it sometimes is hard to shut off your creative brain, that's good, right? Like that. I mean, the actual idea for The Good Place came to me while I was driving home in traffic one day and someone pulled into the breakdown lane and pulled past me in heavy traffic. And I remember I played this game in traffic where I would say, like, that guy just lost 8 points or that guy just lost 15 points. Like, it was a game I had played for years where it was a way to keep me away from road rage. Honestly, was like, instead of like getting furious and honking my horn and screaming about the injustice of what they had done, I would just imagine that we were all playing a video game and that guy had lost a certain number of points by doing something obnoxious. And then I started thinking, like, I wonder if that's a show. I wonder if I could turn this into a thing where there is an actual computational sort of evaluation going on of all of our moral lives and the ethical decisions we make. And that's what led to the show. So, like, that's the fun part of not being able to turn off your creative brain is that it sometimes you get good ideas in unexpected places, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I think the key is like, you can't always be working. You'll go crazy. It won't even be effective. Like, if you're thinking all the time about writing, you're not going to write anything good because you have to have downtime and you have to have other things that you care about. So yeah, that's the long-winded answer. The long-winded way of saying yes and no.
No, I appreciate it. I kind of asked it a long-winded question. Just it could have been like, can you shut off your creative brain? I should have left it there. The podcast, one of your recent ones, is talking about like things that like are the most depressing things in sports. I loved it. And I was just like, you know, I'm a football fan, basketball fan, baseball and hockey, especially right now, hockey playoffs. I'm watching these in the games, but you being a Boston fan, I'm a Red Sox fan. Just with your loyalty to Boston, it's great. You can talk about a series or a game that made you the happiest or one that made you question, should you still follow this team? Because I love the fact that you look at sports. Do you have a moment, either way, can be good or bad, and in the sense of like your fandom and like you're like, yeah, I'm so glad I'm a fan of this team. Or like, what other teams could I probably root for in this sport?
Oh, I mean, look, the history of Boston sports fandom it's a fairly oft explored topic. Like, I don't want to bore people. Like, there's not a lot of people talking about like the Milwaukee Brewers, right? In sports media, there's a lot of people talking about the Red Sox and the Celtics and everything else, and the Patriots, certainly. But the thing that people who aren't Boston sports fans don't understand is that what I'll always hear is like, you guys have won so much, how can you complain? And those people are 100% correct. Like, let me just get that out of the way. They are 100% correct. We have nothing to complain about. The Red Sox have won 4 World Series in the last 18 years. The Celtics won a title with the Big Three. The Patriots win the Super Bowl every year. And the Bruins even won a Stanley Cup a few years ago. There is no question that Red Sox fans are absurdly lucky. Like, probably in my lifetime, even, and this is crazy to say, the luckiest fans on earth. Like, I don't know when fans of another city that you could consider luckier. Like, the Yankees have won a lot of titles too in the last 40, 50 years, but not recently. Like, Red Sox have won 4 of them since 2004. So people who complain about Boston sports fans are 100% correct in their complaints. However, the thing that they miss is that the entire history of the franchise until the year 2004 was pain, misery, racism, institutional failure, just the absolute, where it was 80, 90 years of the most abject and embarrassing failure, moral failure and on the field failure. And so this winning, which has been wonderful, is just barely now getting us back to even, you know, like I know how this sounds, but we're now barely just at the level of like the Cincinnati Reds or the Padres or something, because the history was so tragic. So the worst moment of my sports viewing life, and honestly, and I know how fortunate I am that I can say this, one of the actual worst moments of my life was the Aaron Boone home run in 2003 off Tim Wakefield in the 11th inning of game 7 of the ALCS. That loss was so devastating. I was in New York. I was at my friend Dave King's house, and nobody moved. I lay on the floor and stared at the ceiling for like 2 hours and just like said, like, it's never going to happen. It's never going to happen. They're never going to win. My whole life has been devoted to this hapless, moribund franchise, tainted and stained by racist owners and terrible decisions and institutional failure. And I have given so much of myself to them, and I will never be rewarded for it. And I truly believe that in that moment. And 1 year later, they came down from 03 against the same Yankees in the same ALCS and swept them. Is the first time it ever happened. And then they won the World Series. And that was probably the greatest moment of my life. And true story. So I had just moved to LA and to move in with my then girlfriend, now wife. And my plan was, I moved in June, and the plan was, we're going to live together for a year. And assuming everything goes the way I think it's going to go, I was going to go on a trip. We were going to take a trip the following summer, and I was going to propose on that trip. So she sat next to me for game 4 of the ALCS on the couch. She doesn't care about baseball at all, but she sat to my left. They came back and won in extra innings, the Dave Roberts steal of second, and then the heroic comeback. And I said, sweetheart, I'm very sorry, but you now have to sit on this couch immediately to my left every night until this is over. And they might not work, but you have no choice. And she was like, fine. So she sat to my left on the couch in every single game. They won 3 straight against the Yankees and then 4 straight against the Cardinals with it. And she would just like read a book and like, or do work or whatever. And when they won, and it was the greatest moment of my life, the next day I went and bought an engagement ring and I proposed to Christmas. I was like, I'm moving this up. I'm moving it up 6 months. The timetable has moved up. Like, there's no, if she would do that for me and be there for me in those moments, like, there is nothing else that I could ever ask of her. And so I proposed at Christmas, and we're still married to this day.
That is that is fantastic. 2004, I think, for any Red Sox fan is just remarkable. That book between like Stuart Ornan and Stephen King, Believe.
Yeah.
Great book. Mm-hmm. 2004, October 15th is my wedding date for me and my wife. She's from Jersey. I grew up in New Hampshire, right? So the first 3 games, like, she goes down to New Jersey before the wedding. I'm hanging out at the apartment. My buddies and I were playing poker games, watching the first 3 games. Oh, the first 2 games, and we're like, okay, this is great. Well, we're just going to get swept. Game 3, we're in the hotel room in New Jersey. We're playing poker, and like, all right, fine. Game 4 was supposed to be the 15th, but it got rained out, and I had the DJ because there was Boston and New York Yankees fans. And like, game 4 is canceled. It's not happening tonight. Just enjoy the wedding. So I was like, do that. And then I remember watching those games because we went to like Playa del Carmen in Mexico, watching him in like Spanish, blah, 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 Manny Ramirez. I'm like, yay. And then I remember I came home. And this is like, I felt like I was a 60-year-old man. We were going to, my friend's like, you just got home. They're going to probably beat the Cardinals in the World Series. We should come out to Boston with it. I'm like, no, I got to fold laundry. I got to pay bill. Like, I'm good. And everyone is like enjoying it in Fenway Park. And I'm just folding laundry. Like, I'm excited they won. I'm like, why am I doing this?
Yeah. Yeah. I know. I had the chance to potentially go to one of the two World Series games that year. And I said no, mostly because I was working on the office at the time, but also because I was legitimately worried that if I changed my routine that they wouldn't win. Like that's how psycho I was. Like I was like, if I don't sit on my couch and my wife isn't to my, or my girlfriend isn't to my immediate left, and they lose, I'll never forgive myself. And then they won four straight, and a little part of me to this day thinks that I'm the reason.
Thank you so much for those stories and just sharing your thoughts on Father. Now we're gonna finish off with the Father and Quick Five. Favorite family movie? Do you guys have one right now?
What was it most recently? And Encanto probably. Okay. was the my daughter was obsessed with Encanto and watched it like 8 times in 5 days, I would say. Like more than once a day for a solid week.
Nice. Favorite family song, or is there a band or an artist that, and now because of your kids of your ages, I kind of can be either way. Like, is there a band that you introduce them to, or is there a band that they introduce you to and you're like, oh, these are pretty good?
My son is exclusively interested in contemporary hip hop. And most of it is not, is explicit to the point where I'm like covering my 11-year-old daughter's ears. the thing that happened recently that delighted me was she's plays the clarinet, and one of the songs they're playing at their spring concert is Obla Di Obla Da. And I have tried my entire life to make either of my kids give the tiniest amount of crap about the music from my life, and it has failed. But that Obla Di Obla Da has given me a little window, and so now I play a little classic rock, a little Beatles in the car, and I'm chipping away. I'm like chipping away at her, and she's like getting a little more interested in the music from my lifetime. And so I'm hoping that continues. But right now it's Obla Di Obla Da by the Beatles.
Well done, sir. All right, so I don't know, you guys Marvel, like the MCU fans at all?
Yes, my son is obsessed, yeah.
Maybe a way is to kind of, when you watch Guardians of the Galaxy, just play that soundtrack, right?
Yeah, it has not worked with him. I've tried everything with him. He's like, the only thing that he has been excited about in the last like 6 months is the new Kendrick Lamar album. Like that was like, he had a like listening party with his friends on FaceTime. They all listened to it simultaneously and just talked about it and everything. So I don't think like 70s funk is going to cut it.
Awesome. Describe the perfect family vacation. Where would it be?
We went to Costa Rica for, it was the first time traveling in the entire pandemic. We went last Christmas and it ruled. It was so fun that even my like TikTok obsessed son was like kind of into it. Like we went whitewater rafting and we there were monkeys in the trees and like nice. There was a real, like at one point we were in our hotel room and something fell out of a tree and I was like, oh look, it's a monkey. And then I looked and I was like, no, it's an anteater. There's a goddamn anteater right outside our window. That's amazing. We took a video of like, it really was like a magical place. And I was like, this is our perfect vacation. It's like an interesting place with a different climate that has like the kind of like endless wonder and enchantment, like, and like jet skiing. Like my son loved jet skiing. Like that was like, there was kind of something for everyone. So that's probably as close as we get to a perfect vacation.
Nice. And the best thing, like if parents want to know where to go, it's like, parents of teenagers, the kid put the phone down, you know it's a good place to go, right?
Yes. And he put his phone down and we went whitewater rafting and he liked it, and that was like a huge victory.
Nice. This one is not a question, it's just a statement. Please, just for everything holy, keep on doing weekend observations on the Dan Le Batard show. That is I'm like laughing out loud. I have my headphones on and I'm laughing out loud and everyone's like, what are you laughing at? I'm like, yeah, he said, you know, the guy that, you know, wrote The Good Place, all stuff, like he does the weekend observations. It's just like, they don't get the show because no one listens to it but me.
Right.
But I'm like, just, I mean, I know you're following Stu Gatz and, you know, all that good stuff, but like, everything you're doing is just so spot on, and I just love it. So thank
I'm glad to hear it. Thank you. Yeah, I've done it twice now. I don't want to do it too much. I don't want to overstay my welcome, but whether I do it again anytime soon depends on whether the Celtics beat the Heat in this playoff series. If the Heat win, I'm not doing it for like 6 months. If the Celtics win, I'll be on next week.
I totally understand that, but I guess I just want to say that that's one of the best things right now going on in podcast. Besides your podcast, of course, podcast.
Thank you.
Lastly, top three words you hope your kids would use to describe you as a dad. What would you want them to be?
Patient, fair, and funny. Nice. I think those would be the ideal ones. Like I'm terrified that they will think. I'm worried all the time that they will see me as being unfair. That might be number one. Like I think fairness is the key to parenting at some level. It's like be even keeled, don't over punish or over reward, like treat everything with the appropriate amount of attention that it deserves and no more or less. Like that's kind of the closest I can come to like a single parenting mantra.
Nice. Love it. People, make sure you follow Mike on Twitter at Ken Tremendous. Pick up his book, How to Be Perfect, wherever books are sold. Thank you so much for this. This was just such an honor to have you on the show and talk about your fatherhood journey. I wish you and your family continued success, sir.
Thank you, buddy. Talk to you soon.
I want to thank RPAC for being this week's sponsor for the Art of Fatherhood podcast. I've been working with them for years now, and I really appreciate their dedication to not only keep kids safe online, but teach families, not just kids, but families, healthy digital habits so that they can embrace technology but not overuse it. Go to rpac.com for more information and check them out at your mobile device app store. Please rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, and also go to artoffatherhood.net. You can have a chance to check out some great articles like the weekly Dad's Doing It Right column, the Collector of the Week, and many more. Plus, you have a chance to win some very cool prizes like video games, collectibles, all that good stuff. Go to artoffatherhood.net, and please make sure you rate, subscribe, and review wherever you listen to podcasts, because I'll greatly appreciate it to get the word out on the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Thank you so much.
Thanks for listening to the Art of Fatherhood podcast. Leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and go to artoffatherhood.net.